Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, working to support students, educators, and public schools as the center of their communities through the Public Schools Unite Us initiative, and United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org. Once a month, New York Governor Kathy Hochul answers questions directly from her constituents. WNYC's John Campbell reports on the ones she isn't answering.
Back in May, the governor's office launched a new series on its YouTube page. It's called Ask the Gov.
Well, we asked you to submit your questions to me, and we got literally 600 submissions. So in order to answer them all, let's get started. I'm really excited.
In the video, she's sitting at a table in her office on 3rd Avenue. She's talking straight to the camera and answering things like,
big question from 4-year-old Everett from Delmar. Is it your job to paint the lines on the road? Great question, Everett.
That got me thinking. What other questions did the governor get? You know, the ones she didn't answer. So I filed an open records request and asked my colleagues to read some of them.
How are you going to pay for your grandiose plans?
Why are you oblivious to crime?
You said you wanted to close
city.
5 prisons.
Did
Which
you
ones
fully
would they
restore
be?
Medicaid funding?
Why don't you get rid of Alvin
Bragg? Why
can't
you fix the potholes?
What if Trump wins the election?
They weren't all that direct or angry, but a lot of them were. And it was basically a window into voters' minds right in the middle of a presidential election. They touched on things like affordability.
Why do our taxes keep increasing? We've lived in this house for 50 years.
Immigration.
What is the plan to stop the busloads of migrants coming into the city?
And crime.
Have you lost your mind? Put bail back on the table.
That question from the 4-year-old about painting lines on the road? It wasn't on the list of questions submitted through the governor's website, the list I got through the open records request. The governor's office said staff members asked around after they didn't get questions from young people early on. The very first question the governor answered was on the list. Sort of.
We heard from Palmer H. in Syracuse, who's wondering something that's on the minds of so many New Yorkers. How are we going to deal with the affordability crisis and build more housing and have more protections for tenants upstate?
That was the gist of the question Palmer H. submitted, but the governor's office made a key change. Palmer actually asked about a specific type of tenant protection called good cause eviction, which aims to stop landlords from evicting tenants without a specific reason. Landlords tend to hate it. And the governor never mentioned good cause eviction by name. Not when she read the question, not when she answered it.
And we have tenant protections that every community can adopt. It's up to them, but they're in place, as well as incentives for developers to build more upstate, not just in New York City, which is where I'm
It's a thorny political topic for the governor, whose campaign gets a lot of money from real estate interests. I wondered what the person who wrote the question thought of the governor's edit. Hi, Palmer. How are you?
I'm good. What's up?
That's Palmer Harvey. She's an Onondaga County legislator and a tenant activist from Syracuse. Did you submit that question?
It sounds like me. It was 6 months ago, yeah.
Palmer didn't know the governor answered her question, so I had her watch the video. I noticed in the video, they took out the words good cause eviction.
Yeah, that's not surprising.
At the time, the governor and state lawmakers had just passed a housing package that included some good cause eviction protections, but they weren't as strong as tenant activists wanted. And they only apply to New York City. Upstate cities, like Syracuse, have to opt in.
To me, it's more of like a giveaway to the landlords, even though the landlords don't think it's a giveaway to them at all, you know?
Palmer says she gets why Governor Hochul's office changed up her question. The governor was never a fan of the original good cause eviction bill, and activists like Palmer spent years pressing her on it.
Let's be honest, you know? So this is not our first rodeo. We've been trying to get that since 2019 in the state, right?
As for who paints the lines on the road, well, the governor told 4-year-old Everett she's got people for that.
Maybe someday you're going to want to become part of our state workforce and you can be the one who helps paint the lines. But we have.
You can submit your questions to Governor Hochul at ny.gov/askthegov. In Albany, I'm John Campbell for the New York Public News Network.
are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. This week, I sat down with Democratic State Senator James Skoufis and asked him about his candidacy to become the next chair of the Democratic National Committee.
Well, I think most Democrats woke up the next day after November 5th with viscerally strong feelings about where our party needs to head from here. And look, you know, we need to do things differently, I believe, in the National Democratic Party. The next DNC chair ought not be the operative type or the product of a party machine or a DC Beltway guy. We've tried all of those things many times over, and here we are, completely locked out of power in Washington. And so I am admittedly the outsider in this race. I wear that as a badge as I'm having my conversations with the 448 members of the DNC who get a vote on February 1st. And look, you know, we just need to get back to winning. That's all that I would be focused on as the next DNC chair. That's all what the Democratic Party needs to be focused on, is getting back to winning in a dominant way. For the past over a decade now, we've either been losing or white-knuckling it across the finish line, eking out very tight races. The last time we had a really dominant performance was all the way back in 2008. You've got to go to a presidential election, President Obama's first election. And so, you know, that's my main focus. I come from a district that Donald Trump won by 12 percentage points a few weeks ago, while I won re-election by 14. In fact, he's won my district three times over now. And so I know what it takes to win. I know how to communicate with people, including those who have left our once big Democratic tent. And I look forward to bringing that coalition building skill set as the next DNC chair.
Well, I'm wondering whether you think it's something that the folks in the DNC will hope is that they get an outsider. So, for example, DNC chair, the current chair, Jamie Harrison, is not seeking a second term. Other candidates who have joined the race include Ken Martin, the chairman of the Democratic Party in Minnesota, and former Maryland Governor Martin O'Malley. How do you separate yourself out and gather some name recognition here beyond the major candidates that are in?
So there are two ways I'm accomplishing that. One is I'm speaking to wonderful reporters and journalists and media outlets like yours, and I'm getting my name out there so that the broader Democratic Party can understand who I am and my rationale for running, and most importantly, the approach I would take as the next DNC chair. But I'm also having what will be hundreds, if not thousands, of one-on-one calls and meetings with the 448 voting members of the DNC who will cast ballots on February 1st. I know full well that I'm starting as the outsider in this race. I don't come into the contest with a list as long as my arm of years-long DNC relationships, in some cases, for some of my competitors, decades-long DNC relationships. I respect the other candidates running. I've spoken with them. I've met a number of them. And for example, Ken Martin has done an excellent job as state party chair in Minnesota, and same for Ben Wickler in Wisconsin. But as I'm having these conversations with the voting members, there's an enormous desire to, again, do this differently and, you know, not necessarily just knee-jerk go along with someone who has the relationships. They have an intense desire to choose someone, to elect someone to be the next DNC chair who knows how to win the nuts and bolts of campaigns, someone who's going to be able to go everywhere, to every corner of this country, no matter how traditionally uncomfortable some of those meeting rooms and media outlets and communities may have been for Democrats and the Democratic Party. That's where I've lived and breathed for 12 years in a district like mine in the Hudson Valley, where that is predominantly red. I go into those meeting rooms. I go into the Elks clubs. I go to speak with media outlets that may be less than friendly traditionally to Democrats. And I'm able to have those conversations. I'm able to coalition build, bring people back under our tent. And we've got to start doing that nationally again.
We're speaking with New York State Senator James Skoufis. He has thrown his hat into the ring to become the next chair of the Democratic National Committee. You're hearing some of his rationale now. Now, there's a part of this that's very important, right? Raising money. Now, that's something politicians don't like when it comes to running for election. But you got to be able to raise money if you're going to run the DNC.
That's right. In an off year, you're talking a few hundred million dollars as a DNC budget. And in a presidential year, a major election cycle, it's many hundreds more on top of that. Now, look, you know, I think it's fair and objective to say that I'm one of the strongest fundraisers in New York State politics. I know how to have those conversations with donors, and I'll be able to continue the strong fundraising success that the DNC has exhibited in recent years. But there's a piece of this that's equally, if not more important, and that is how we're spending that money that comes into the DNC. And for a very long time, years if not decades, we've been getting ripped off as a party. The DC consultant class has acted like hogs at a trough in you know, developing these contracts with the DNC that are 7 and 8 figures in cost. And the only reason some of them are getting that business is because they're friends of a friend of a congressman or some you know, otherwise well connected to the DNC and its membership. That needs to end. And I'm uniquely situated in this race as the outsider, if I'm fortunate enough to be elected, to walk through those doors and on day one, let every single one of those vendor contracts expire. Let's go out to rebid in a competitive, fair fashion, find savings. And here's the important part. Shift away that money from the DC consultant class that I will owe nothing to, and send that money to the folks in the trenches, the state parties, the county parties, new partnerships with organized labor. That's where that money needs to go, not to yet another vendor who's ripping us off to send 700 more text messages to voters a couple of weeks ahead of the election to harass them and create no value for the DNC and the Democratic Party. And so that's where I'm also well situated here as the outsider. I will owe nothing to the green room circuit in Washington or the cocktail circuit in Washington. I'll be able to go there into the DNC on day one and make serious structural changes. No more tweaking around the edges. We need a lot more than that out of the next DNC and the next DNC chair.
That's Democratic State Senator James Skoufis. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer is raising the alarm over a so-called telehealth cliff that could impact more than 200,000 upstate New York seniors. The Legislative Gazette's Aaron Shella Levine with more.
The Democrat is calling for bipartisan support of a 2-year extension of Medicare reimbursements for telehealth appointments.
It allows people who can't get to a hospital to get good health care. So it's convenient for them. You don't have to take off a day from work. You don't have to drive 50 miles, wait in the hospital. You just can set up an appointment. So it's good for them. It makes healthcare better. Because if you have a pain or something wrong and you have to make an appointment at a hospital, you say the heck with it. But if you can just sit by your computer or even by your phone, and by the way, it can be used in any kind of phone, even mine. Since I have a flip phone.
Schumer spoke at Nathan LaTower Hospital in Gloversville Wednesday. He says there are nearly 224,000 seniors across the Capital Region and Mohawk Valley covered by Medicare and 14,000 in Fulton County. During the pandemic, the federal government enabled the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to reimburse patients for telehealth expenses, allowing healthcare providers to expand their audio-only services. Schumer says the expansion has improved health care outcomes for New York seniors.
Let's say there's a top specialist who's needed in Syracuse or in New York City or in Rochester. By telehealth, you can say set an appointment and let them come in, which you couldn't get in a hospital here. And it makes it cheaper because everyone's more efficient. So it's a great thing.
Dr. Mike Dinkles transitioned to telehealth appointments prior to the pandemic, but the expansion of federal support allowed his practice to see upwards of 25,000 ICU patients over the past 6 years.
Telemedicine has made me a better provider, has gotten me in touch with more patients, has put me in the right place at the right time with the correct other providers and correct patients in the ICUs locally. We provide telehealth coverage in 7 different counties. Here at Nathan LaTower, this was our first shop pre-COVID. With the rules that were put in place, we expanded. And it'd be great for everybody to expand further.
Devjit Roy is the chief medical officer at the hospital. He says for rural communities, increased access to telehealth appointments can be life-saving.
In our region here, not everyone's got internet, right? Not every patient that's elder can make it into the office. But then it's a lot of the times you have patients that just don't know that they're sick. And those are the scariest ones because they could be young, and they just don't know. So with this extra ability to see these patients, we can actually hit something off when it's early enough, you know? And so I think what's huge for us, a hospital like us needs this type of extension because how else are we going to get help here, right? It's hard to recruit to areas like this.
The legislation that gives CMS the flexibility to cover telehealth appointments is set to expire at the end of the year. Schumer is in his final weeks as majority leader after Republicans took control of the chamber in November's election.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Aaron Shello Levine.
George Latimer's last day as Westchester County Executive will be January 2nd, as the Democrat prepares to represent New York's 16th District in Congress starting next year. While Latimer looks to Washington, his deputy has launched a bid to take his place at home. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Jesse King.
I'm Ken Jenkins, and I know that there is nothing that we can't do together. So I appreciate everyone's support, and let's get to work.
Deputy County Executive Ken Jenkins announced his run for county executive before supporters in White Plains earlier this month. Speaking with WAMC, the Democrat says he wants to continue the investments he and Latimer have made on public safety, mental health, and housing since 2018.
Doing all of those kind of investments while we've been able to hold the line on taxes. I feel it's a tremendous accomplishment, and I think that that's going to bode well for us moving forward. Again, whether the challenging times come from the state or from our federal government.
This isn't Jenkins' first time running for a county executive. He unsuccessfully ran against Latimer in the Democratic primary in 2017 before Latimer appointed him as deputy. This time around, rather than emphasizing anything he might do differently as county executive, Jenkins is running as a steady figure who has already worked with Latimer to lead Westchester through one Trump presidency and who is ready to do it again.
He was the president when we came in 2018. And during that time, we were able to restore our community development block grant funds, the federal dollars that had been lost over those years, and being able to build over 6,000 units of affordable housing. We understand how to navigate through these particular times and work with our federal partners, whether they're Democrat or Republican.
Jenkins says working with federal lawmakers will be crucial if the county hopes to pull in funding for additional housing and climate-resilient infrastructure. Westchester County communities have been frequent sites of flooding in recent years. If elected, Jenkins would be Westchester's first Black county executive. A longtime resident of Yonkers, he served more than a decade in the county board of legislators, including a stint as chairman from 2010 to 2013. He led the Yonkers chapter of the NAACP in the 1990s, but was suspended in part for suggesting that the crosstown busing of schoolchildren to integrated schools had, quote, outlived its usefulness, and that the city's money would be better spent on improving schools for those children. He's also held leadership positions in Democratic committees at the local and state level. Currently, Jenkins serves as chair of New York's Independent Redistricting Commission, a position he would have to step down from if he becomes county executive.
Whether it was me being the chair of the Board of Legislators, whether it was the experience that I've had in the Independent Redistricting Commission, and certainly as deputy county executive with George Latimer, all of those experiences lead us to develop pragmatic solutions by taking the time to have the input and hear from all different points of view.
I do want to announce that I have made the formal designation that effective Thursday, January 2nd of next year, 2025, at 12:01 p.m.
Latimer formally announced his resignation on Monday. Once he wraps his last day on January 2nd, the Board of Legislators will tap an acting county executive and begin planning a special election to take place within 90 days. Jenkins says major parties will need to declare their candidates within 10 days. Whoever wins will fill the last year of Latimer's term, and if they hope to continue in the seat, they must run again in November. That means Jenkins could face three separate elections next year: the special election, a primary, and then the general election in November. But asked about the shakeup on WAMC's Congressional Corner, Latimer said Jenkins is up to the task.
Ken and I have worked as a team in so many ways in public. Many times you get a governor and a lieutenant governor, they run together and you don't see the lieutenant governor. Or a president and a vice president, and you don't see the vice president. In Westchester County, you've seen me and Ken doing things together for all of these 7 years. So he is ready to be a great county executive. The voters will decide, but I think Ken is more than ready.
Jenkins is the only candidate to toss his hat in the ring so far. The Westchester Republican County Committee did not return a request for comment Tuesday. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Jesse King.
You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Giustina. Spending time outdoors is part of what draws so many people to the Adirondacks. But that experience can be out of reach for people with sensory or mobility issues. North Country Public Radio's David Escobar reports on a festival that's adapting outdoor recreation to make it accessible to everyone.
Helene Gibbons is leading about 20 people on a walk at the Barnum Brook Trail at Paul Smith's Visitor Interpretive Center. She asked her tour group to close their eyes and listen to the sounds of bird chirps and the breeze hitting tree leaves.
And feel or sense how you're surrounded by an infinite variety of life forms.
She even leans into that forest soundscape to get her tour group to circle up.
So usually I call you back with an owl hoot. And it sounds like this.
Gibbons is a nature therapy guide for Adirondack River Walking. She leads therapeutic walks known as forest bathing.
Our objective on the walk is to help connect people with nature in a more intimate way, slowing down, using their senses, because when we do, it makes us mindful.
Gibbons' tour group is visiting the Vic for the first ever Adirondack Nature Festival for people with disabilities. The people attending today's festival have a range of needs when it comes to being in the outdoors. Some have visual impairments, others use wheelchairs. So Gibbons says she made sure each member of her tour group had the proper accommodations for the hike.
This trail that we used today is the section that we used is ADA compliant. It means that it is easy, level, that the surface is free of rocks, ruts, roots, and so that as people who have mobility issues walk on the trail, they don't have to be concerned.
Along the trail, Gibbons talks about the things she hears, sees, and smells. She points out a birch tree stripped of its bark and holds balsam fir needles in her hand for hikers to smell. She says it's something she does for all of her tours, but can be especially impactful for people with disabilities.
It just feels like a more connected, complete experience.
That's Katie Carroll. She traveled from Albany to attend today's festival. Carroll is legally blind. She says the forest bathing tour allowed her to experience things she rarely gets to encounter in nature.
Well, one thing that I know is out there is that there are all these different kinds of trees and different leaf shapes, and I can see the color, so I can tell that there are different like greens out there, but I don't know why, and I don't know that what they are.
So Carroll says having a guide to describe her surroundings is key to getting the most out of the outdoors.
You know, we encourage people to go out in nature and have a walk and all of the good things that come along with being outside and being in nature, and people are going to experience that differently. And so this just means that everyone gets to have a complete experience.
The forest bathing walk is just one of the ways the festival is connecting people with disabilities to nature. There's also bird watching, nature painting classes, and inside one classroom, nature sensory play.
A lot of times we'll put them together, so play yours and play this one. We make a little.
That's the sound of nature music. It's part of an immersive sensory workshop led by Suzanne Weirich. She's inviting visitors to grab pieces of wood, leaves, and shelves off of a table to create drum beats. She says tactile experiences like this can be enriching for anyone.
Every table is set up for a sensory experience. So this is all forest music, for instance. So it's touch, it's hearing, it's smell, it's taste. So all of these different tables intermingle or specify one of those different aspects of the senses.
There are fragrant greens, textured tree barks, edible plants. Wyrick says sensory play with these pieces of the forest can give people a new perspective on how they can experience the outdoors.
It opens doors. You know, they might feel a stick under their foot and they go to pick it up and it's like, oh yeah, touching it, feeling it. So it brings joy. It brings you, it kind of returns you to that childhood sense of wonder and awe.
Wyrick says closeness to nature is something we all crave. And festival volunteer Aminda Briety says it's important that feeling is accessible to anyone.
This festival and these experiences are a way to make sure people, all people, feel included and seen and heard and cared about in the Adirondacks, because that's who we are.
Organizers say the Accessible Nature Festival is the first of its kind in the state. And after a successful first year, they're hoping to make it an annual tradition. In Paul Smith's, I'm David Escobar for the New York Public News Network.
And that about does it for this week's show. The Legislative Gazette is a production of WAMC. We had help from the New York Public News Network. You can listen anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. Look for program number 2449 and join us again next week at this same time. For more news on New York state government and politics, for the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Gustina. Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President, UUPinfo.org.